Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for over 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Each year in July, cocktailians by the tens of thousands descend on New Orleans for an industry convention unlike any other. Tales of the Cocktail. This week, we take you behind the scenes of the annual five-day event and meet some of the people you might run into there. We begin with Charlotte Voisy, who was just named Executive Director of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. As a Tales participant since 2006, Charlotte has seen firsthand how the annual conference has grown over the years. She lets us in on this year's theme, Evolve, and how it applies to both the drinks industry and Tales itself. Next, we speak with Eric Seed, who's been called the Indiana Jones of Lost Spirits. He relates the story of House Alpens, his import company renowned for reviving obscure and rare liquors. Then, distiller Jackie Summers introduces us to Sorrel, a magical sip straight from the Caribbean islands. Finally, we learn what inspired Tim Etherington Judge to found Healthy Hospo, an initiative that aims to make the hospitality industry a healthier and happier place. Break out the ice, the bar's open, on this week's Louisiana Eats. First Tales of the Cocktail kicked off in the summer of 2002 as a walking tour of New Orleans French Quarter bars. Now, 23 years later, Tales has become the drinks world's biggest event. And almost since the beginning, Charlotte Voisy has been a ubiquitous presence. For nearly two decades, you could find Charlotte practically everywhere at Tales, whether she was organizing parties, moderating seminars, or heading up the Spirited Awards. Louisiana Eats spoke with Charlotte at several Tales events over the years. First, when she was brand ambassador for William Grant & Sons, and later, when she was the company's director of advocacy. In the latter position, she helped redefine how spirits brands connect with the hospitality industry. We got a glimpse of her work in action in 2018. Every year, William Grant throws an opening night party, a big, lavish event for some 1,500 guests. That year, with Tales more focused on health and wellness in the industry, the company threw the conference's first ever non-alcoholic party. On a rainy July night, just before the event kicked off, Charlotte explained to us why this party would be dry.
So the heart and soul of this party, and this year's no different, it's always been this way, has been the connections between people and the camaraderie that we have between our ambassador team and with the bartender community. People think that we gather to drink, but in actual fact, we gather to see each other, to hug it out, to chat, to share ideas, to meet mentors, to catch up on what in some cases is a year without seeing these people. So it's the relationships, it's the social moment. All of that still applies. And we'll still be serving delicious things to drink and eat. They just, it won't be with alcohol.
Earlier this year, The Tales of the Cocktail Foundation announced Charlotte Voisy as its new executive director. Charlotte joined us virtually to discuss her new role and how Tales has evolved in the last 20 years. Charlotte, it is so nice to welcome you to Louisiana Eats again. The last time I interviewed you, it was in the midst of an unbelievable thunderstorm, and we taped the interview in the back of a car on the dock in New Orleans, because that was the time. Do you remember that?
Oh my God, I do now that you've said that. We did it in the back of the car in the pouring rain. That must have been 2018, because we were setting up for our Spirit Free party that year. Wow. That's got to be one of those Tales moments. Like, where else could that possibly happen?
Charlotte, there's so many of those, aren't there?
There really are. Like, the highlight reel of our time at Tales would just be epic.
Now you're the new executive director for the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. So explain the work of the foundation and what the vision that you're bringing to this is.
So, Tales of the Cocktail Foundation, parties and wonderful memories aside, has played and still does such an important role in the industry. As a foundation, our mission is to educate, support, and advance the global drinks community, right? And it's quite a lofty statement, and there's a lot in there. It's really about meeting the needs, anticipating how we can help and support bartenders, bar owners, industry members through the roller coaster rides that each year sort of continues to bring in our spirits industry. Be there to share resources, be there to provide the platform for the conversations that need to happen, providing opportunities for people to come and gather and network and support each other, celebrate as well, discuss, brainstorm solutions and ideas as needed, but really be that hub and that space that the industry can lean on. That's really why Tales of the Cocktail Foundation exists. That's our mission, to keep that sort of support afloat and really help the industry continue to survive and thrive each year. And that can mean different things for different countries and different communities around the world. But there are many common denominators that everyone can kind of lean on and gain from. And that's what we strive to provide.
Some of the topics that I know the foundation has touched on during Tales have been things like sexual harassment, wear and tear, and then, of course, just the hardcore wellness that needs to be communicated to what can be a very dangerous industry to enter and a very dangerous job.
Yes. So we have one of our four tracks of education is called Beyond the Bar. And that is everything that kind of goes beyond cocktail making, technique, history of spirits, all of the important information that bartenders need to know. And it really allows us to delve into wellness of the bartender. And that is everything from physical wellness to mental wellness, to the ability to be a good leader for others in your team, to be a supportive co-worker, everything that comes along with looking after yourself and others in the industry. And again, this can mean different things for different people. And one of the reasons that it is so important is bartending or cocktail consulting or becoming a brand ambassador or owning a bar. There are many pathways now in our industry that perhaps didn't exist 10 or 20 years ago. People are staying in this industry for a lot longer. And there are temptations, there are physical demands on the work of a bartender. So what we're trying to do is set people up for success so they have the option to stay in the industry for longer. They have the option to pursue a long career doing what they love rather than sort of coming in, quickly getting burnt out for one of many reasons and then having to go find to do something else that they don't like. Because that's not good for their own job satisfaction, but also it can take great people out of the industry.
And of course, we want to keep great people in the industry because that's really what feeds hospitality. So the wellness piece is really important. Every year we rotate around different topics that feed into that track. And this year is no different. We've got some great seminars coming up on those topics.
As a Tales of the Cocktail participant since 2006, naturally, you have a very long vision when it comes to Tales of the Cocktail's evolution over the years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating that this year's theme is evolve. Tell me what your thoughts are on the evolving liquor industry today.
Yeah, evolve is such a great theme. It is the theme for 2025. It could really be the theme of Tales of the Cocktail in its entirety. One could argue it could be the theme each year, right? Because each year we do evolve and the seminar topics evolve and the brand parties change. And every year Tales might sort of look similar, but the actual conversations and discussions and education happening evolve every year. They're different. But I've always thought, I came over in 2006 and Tales had already started by then, but it was still the early years. And it was sort of the years where the American modern cocktail renaissance was really kicking into gear, right? People like Dale DeGroff and David Wunderich and Julie Reiner were really just sort of starting to break through and demonstrate how things could be done really well and galvanizing that educational movement. So for me, my sort of timeline of how the industry in the US has evolved, Tales of the Cocktail is right there. And I used to always say and still believe that Tales was like that annual point where you could see the evolution because you could look at the seminar topics year on year and see how trends were changing, evolving, picking up steam. You know, back in 2006, we didn't have six seminars on agave spirits. Maybe we had one, maybe not at all. But now, of course, it's become a massive trend. So there's a lot more conversation and interaction and education on something like that spirit category. And in different ways, other trends, you can see them through the Spirited Award winners as well. You can see what type of bars are trending, what type of markets or countries around the world are leading the charge in cocktail creation. You can look at these lists year on year and literally kind of see how the industry is moving and shifting and which trends kind of take over. So Tales of the Cocktail has provided a wonderful archive for us to look back on and look forward to sort of see where the trends are coming and going. I think it's really quite clever.
One of the things that changed pretty dramatically about Tales of the Cocktail was that it used to always take place over a weekend. And yep. Of course, you all have now cleverly put it during a work week, which mm-hmm. certainly makes sense for the industry. But yep. I think that it's important to point out Tales of the Cocktail isn't just for bar professionals, because lay people, New Orleans residents, other folks can come and get involved and participate in some of these events too. Give me an idea of, aside from industry folks, what the, shall we say, lay drinker might be looking for.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We do have the guest, right? The bar guest, we could call them, attending Tales. A small percentage compared to bar and industry, but growing, creeping up year after year. And they're absolutely welcome. Again, I think the way that we organize the seminars in different tracks, whether it's culture versus business or beyond the bar, which is wellness, the culture seminars are perhaps a little bit more accessible to a bar guest who doesn't have to be a professional advanced bartender to enjoy hearing about the history of cocktail culture in different countries is always a nice way to ease them into things. And then we have a lot of what we call the spirited drinking and spirited dining events. And these take place in the wonderful bars and restaurants of New Orleans, which locals already love, and visiting guests or consumers can get to know and really enjoy getting a bit of a taste of Tales of the Cocktail without sort of feeling that they're in the wrong room or feeling that they can't keep up with sort of the advanced bartender knowledge. So there really is something for everyone in the agenda. And who knows, that might be something that evolves over the next few years also.
Now, Charlotte, when you come here and make your annual pilgrimage to a hot New Orleans in July, what do you look forward to here in New Orleans?
Oh, well, first of all, I love New Orleans. I think it's a massive part of why Tales has such a special place in a lot of people's hearts, myself included. I love the historic bars. I like to kind of pay homage and go on a pilgrimage and see some of those old sites, whether it's Napoleon House or Arnault's, French 75, Brennan's, I love. So I love checking in on some of the sort of institutions that have paved the way for New Orleans. On a more personal note, I have a hot yoga studio that I love called Magnolia Yoga, which I always have to check into, especially during Tales. It keeps me right. That's my wellness piece for the week. But I've always found the people of New Orleans to be just so genuinely nice. And it's a reason why so many of us are so delighted to come back each year.
Charlotte, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats. And I personally can't wait to see you at Tales this year.
I'm looking forward to it, Poppy. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Charlotte Wasse, Executive Director of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. Coming up next, we learn why the owner of a Minnesota-based import company has become known as the Indiana Jones of lost spirits. We sit down with regular Tales attendee Eric Seed when Louisiana Eats returns after the break. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce, creators of local hot sauce for more than 100 years. Always made with just three simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. From Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry offers a mix specially blended for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Rouse's Markets, synonymous with seafood straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets, homegrown and family owned for 65 years. Wine and spirits importer Eric Seed is dedicated to making the old new again. Dubbed the Indiana Jones of lost spirits, Eric travels the globe in search of rare, obscure, and vintage liquors. And after this alcohol archaeologist makes his discoveries, he brings them to market in the U.S. by way of his Minnesota-based company, House Alpens. 20 years after the launch of his import business, Eric has helped popularize once-forgotten spirits and liquors, with many of his products becoming regular staples in premier cocktail bars across America.
My name is Eric Seed. I'm the principal and owner of House Alpens, a wine and spirits import company based out of the Twin Cities. The origin, the experience is probably not at all unfamiliar to you and to your listeners, that when I was a kid with my parents, whenever we would travel, we would make a point of focusing on the meal and also on finding certain foods and bringing them back home. And when I started to do travel during college and then thereafter, when I did an overseas stint in Austria, I would bring stuff back with me. Eau de vies and liqueurs from the Austrian Alps. Some were different, like a pine liqueur, and there was one that was an alpine cream with bits of pear in it. And so, I mean, there are things with a story behind them that gave a taste and a sensation of the place itself. Some friends that were working in restaurants would rather routinely just raid my closet. And one of them was working in a very fine restaurant, came back and said, you know, hey, Eric, you can actually sell these things. These are kind of useful. And I thought, well, that'd be a nice dream, but I've got to finish grad school. So fast forward to 2004, and we were visiting friends out in Colorado. I stopped into a really nice wine shop and looked around and couldn't find some of these things. And I asked the owner if he had ever heard of pine liqueur and such. And he goes, I know what you're talking about, and I can tell you they're not in the States. But if you or someone you know has the wherewithal to bring them here, I'll buy them. And I said, well, that's interesting. What else are you looking for? And he just, eyes went wide and said, people don't ask me what I'm looking for. They tell me what to take or get upset when I just don't have what they want. He said, yeah, bring them back. I'll buy them. I'll show you around town. I thought, ooh, that sounds interesting. And, you know, my wife said, it's like, look, if you're going to do this thing, it's best to start it before we start having kids, as my tolerance for risk isn't going to get any greater. She said, just make the jump. I made the jump. And boy, probably 10 weeks later, she told me she was pregnant. So yeah, I had to get a move on. I started with the alpine spirits, but when I came to the coast and asked what would be helpful and useful, the request came for ingredients that were in classic cocktails, some of which were either unavailable in the States or not fitting the purpose of the cocktail specifications and recipes. And one of those was creme de violette. So, went on my search and found a few producers, some in France. There were two in Austria. And it turns out a partner I was working with was already working with Violet. So we had the maceration. I guess if you're to say, you know, what felt like the most Indiana Jones of experience, it would actually be with the aged oxidative wine. This category called Carcavelos, that only existed in the States in our lifetimes as a test question. So in the world of Portuguese fortified wines, there are four famous types: Madeira, Port, Muscatel de Setúbal, and then there's this thing called Carcavelos. And Carcavelos, it's a wine that is deliberately oxidized and aged and typically not released for at least, 8 to 10 years. The unfortunate fact for this category is that its growing region was immediately to the west of Lisbon. And that has been the area of greatest residential development along the coastline in the past 150 years. So to this day, there are only three registered producers of this wine, only one of which is still vinifying. So a large part of our work has been just explaining what these things are and why they exist, and trying to offer an explanation for their relevance in service today. Why would something unfamiliar become of interest to someone who didn't even ask to see or to taste, potentially? And I think it's making that point of connection with the aroma or the taste or the experience.
That was Eric Seed, owner of House Alpens, a Minnesota-based import company known for reviving obscure and rare spirits. Jackie Summers is a James Beard finalist, public speaker, and serial entrepreneur. For drinks enthusiasts, he's best known as the founder of the Jack from Brooklyn Distillery and creator of Sorrel Liqueur. He's also the first black distiller to be licensed in the U.S. since Prohibition. After a close brush with death, Jackie quit his job in corporate America and pursued his heart's greatest desire, a job that included drinking in the daytime. He started making Sorrel, a hibiscus liquor reminiscent of the Caribbean-flavored drinks of his childhood.
My name is Jackie Summers. I am the creator of Sorrel Liqueur and the proprietor of Jack from Brooklyn. I remember as a young child my folks cooking traditional Caribbean dishes in my home, and then they would make this drink with the hibiscus flowers, and I just thought to myself, this is the best thing ever. I want to drink this all the time. So as an adult, once I realized you could have this delicious drink with alcohol, well, then I just wanted to make it for myself and for my friends and my family all the time. The ingredients of Sorrel are no secret. There's Moroccan hibiscus, Nigerian ginger, Indonesian cassia and nutmeg, Brazilian clove, and then I put in pure cane sugar and organic grain alcohol. There are no colorants, there are no flavorants. That is the sum and total of the ingredients. Now, what I found out as I researched this was every island in the Caribbean does this slightly differently, and it was all based on how deep you were in the spice route. For example, if you went to Jamaica, they would do hibiscus with allspice and cardamom and orange peel. If you went deeper into the spice route, Trinidad and Tobago, where they have South American influence and Indian influence, then you get nutmeg and ginger and cinnamon. Where my grandparents came from, Barbados, everything was rum. When you source botanicals, what you find out is that it's just like with a grape. It's all about the quality of the soil. So the Moroccan hibiscus, it's an arid climate in a dry soil. The flowers are much more robust and they stand up better in the mix. My feeling was you could get a better representation of what hibiscus really tasted like if it was the star in an ensemble cast. Hibiscus, for people who haven't had it, is very tart, very acidic. It's actually higher in acid than most citrus fruit. But what most people tend to do to compensate for the acidity of the hibiscus is overcut it with sugar. And then it's syrupy and cloying and just not fun. My version of this beverage, which has been around for centuries, has clove on top for brightness. It's got cinnamon notes in the middle for warmth and pepper. The ginger almost perfectly masks the heat of the alcohol. So you never actually taste booze. You just feel booze. And that woody note on bottom in the back, the dry finish, that's nutmeg. So instead of it being a single flavor, it is a procession of flavors. You know, there's a joke I tell people. If mom's apple pie and dad's liquor cabinet got together and got busy, the bastard child would be Sorrel.
That was Jackie Summers, creator of Sorel Liqueur. Jackie recently finished a 3-year term as co-chair of the Education Committee for the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. And he's one of the many cocktailians you'll find at Tales each year. Coming up next, we speak with Tim Etherington Judge, founder of Healthy Hospo, an initiative that aims to make the hospitality industry a healthier and happier place. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, made right here in Louisiana for over 95 years. And now, Blue Plate Hot and Spicy Mayo blends their only the egg yolks recipe with cayenne pepper heat. Blue Plate's Hot and Spicy Mayo in grocery stores everywhere or online at blueplatemayo.com. And from Ralph's on the Park, announcing the return of their summer tradition, a light offering of 3 appetizers with a glass of wine, including more than a dozen choices with classics like shrimp scully, turtle soup, and crispy fried oysters with remoulade sauce. Now through September 14th, Ralph's on the Park, dinner nightly, lunch Wednesday through Friday, and serving brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Whether it's behind the bar, on the floor, or in the kitchen, working in the hospitality industry can take its toll on one's physical and mental health. To meet industry demands, hospitality professionals often work long hours, have no set sleep schedule, and consume unhealthy diets. Stress combined with these bad habits can result in an emotional burden too heavy for workers to handle on their own. Tim Etherington Judge is a bartender and former brand ambassador whose story is like so many of those in the hospitality world. Following his own mental breakdown and recovery, Tim discovered how widespread mental and physical health problems are throughout the industry. To tackle it, Tim established Healthy Hospo in 2017, which seeks to improve the health and wellness of hospitality professionals everywhere. In July 2018, Healthy Hospo was a recipient of the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation's first ever grants program and was a featured participant in the Tales Initiative Beyond the Bar, annual programming that addresses the health and well-being of the liquor and bar industry. That year, Tim joined us at Tales to share his story, starting with his globe-trotting career in hospitality that began while he was growing up in a small town in southwest England. A warning to listeners, this story does discuss the topic of suicide.
Hospitality that always was where my heart was at. I'm very fortunate to grow up on the beach, but it's also a very tourist-driven area. So as a young kind of teenager, the only jobs really available are jobs in hospitality. And I had a father who worked in hospitality. So my first job at 14 was working for my dad in a little coffee shop. And then I kind of progressed from there into a burger chain. And then I had like jobs in bar backs and doing a little bit of work in bars, and was always kind of in hospitality. And every time I tried to escape the industry and go and get a different type of job, I always got sucked back in. So 2005 was a big year for me. I was working at Falmouth, and very suddenly and out of the blue, my mum passed away. And I was very, very close to my mum. And that was, as a 28-year-old man, that was a huge moment in my life. And it happened 4 days before Christmas. And then within 5 months, I'd quit my job, bought a one-way plane ticket to New Zealand and left the country. Kind of, it was two things. It was like the last gift my mum gave to me was the freedom to go and travel. Because I never would have kind of spent years away from home while she was alive. And then I think it was also a little bit of a case of kind of just, I need to get out of here. So I went to New Zealand. Got myself a job in a flair cocktail bar. It was so much fun. It was so vibrant, so exciting. And then one day, this guy came into the bar and he told me about this cocktail competition that they were doing. So I spent kind of a good 3-4 weeks kind of crafting this cocktail to enter this competition. And I submitted the recipe and they really liked it. And they invited me as one of the top 10 to go and perform on stage at the Auckland Regionals. And I managed to kind of make the top two and then go on to represent New Zealand at the 42 Below Cocktail World Cup. And that was kind of my first real insight and realization that this could be like a really big career that could take me around the world. This could be something really, really amazing. So then carried on, did some more competitions, managed to get myself a job running the best bar in Auckland, a little bar called Sweet. And everything was going really, really well. But the pressures of the industry, so Sweet was a bar that closed at 5 a.m. in the morning. Lots of the other bartenders would come there for their after-work drinks. So sometimes you wouldn't get home till 11 o'clock in the morning, maybe have 3 hours sleep. And yeah, 90, 100-hour weeks were not uncommon at that bar. And I, looking back now, I had my first breakdown. I went down to work one day and was just in a really dark place. Drank a bottle of tequila, started abusing the staff, throwing things around. And never went back to that job. That breakdown there and then and the aftermath of it was really kind of, for me, the end of that period in New Zealand. Whilst I stayed a little bit longer, I went and worked in a couple of other bars, but everything was such a huge step down from running that bar, and that's where my heart was and all of my passion. It was kind of like the beginning of the end of my time in New Zealand. And I managed to get a job in India. During my time there, I was offered the role as a brand ambassador working for Diageo in India. 3 years there, and I was drained. I told the company I was leaving, and I got a call from a very senior person in the company and said, you're not leaving the company, we'll find you something else. So I went to join the Africa team. Africa was about a year, and I found myself as the global brand ambassador for a small little Kentucky bourbon brand called Bullet. So yeah, just that kind of dream job of traveling the world as a global and having that kind of business card as a global ambassador took me to 63 countries around the world. But for all of the amazing opportunities and experiences that job gives you, there is also a very difficult side to that job. And it's a side that not very often is talked about. And it's the impact on your health, your personal well-being that job demands. You know, I would take 70 to 100 flights a year. Sometimes I would spend 200 and 250 days on the road away from home. Sometimes it seemed like, is there even a point renting an apartment in London, like spending all this money? I was existing on a life of almost semi-permanent jet lag. My sleep patterns were just all over. There was no pattern to it. It was just all over the place. You know, sometimes I would go a week with only sleeping 3 hours a night, and it would be like fly into London, land at Heathrow, get on the tube for an hour to get home, maybe get 3 hours of sleep, unpack and repack my bag, get back on the tube, go back to the airport, get on a plane, go somewhere else, and then land, go to the hotel. The loneliness and the isolation. You are constantly either on your own at airports, on planes, in taxis, in hotel rooms, or you're having these kind of intermediate relationships with people. You know, it's like these 5-minute friendships where you might see people once a year, twice a year, maybe 3 or 4 times a year if you're lucky. So you're constantly kind of trying to make new friends, but what you're missing out is the deep, meaningful friendships of people that you've known for a long time, that you see on a regular basis. . 2016 was my biggest year of travel. I'd done some really big stints, and I was asked to go and speak at the Athens Bar Show in November. And I remember going there, and I was just empty, absolutely empty before I arrived. And my ex-girlfriend was from Athens. So I was kind of going there with some expectations of seeing her and hoping that she would kind of pick me up a little bit, which is not the right kind of attitude to go there with anyway. And she was super busy, and just one thing led to another, and I just fell into the darkest of dark holes. Did my presentation, and I went back to the hotel room and tried to commit suicide. You know how we always kind of like look to the future and we think that the future is going to be brighter and better things will happen, and we're always excited about the future. And for me, it was that complete loss of hope of anything would ever happen again. There was an interview I read with Anthony Bourdain after he passed away, and there was a line in the interview that just really struck a chord with me, and he said, "What do you do when all of your dreams have come true?" We spend so much of our time chasing these dreams, chasing these achievements, thinking that if we can only reach this point and make this happen, then everything will be magical. But then you reach that point. You know, I had that job that I'd always wanted, the global ambassador job that I'd always wanted. And I thought that if I got that job, I would be the happiest person alive. But then when you get that job, it's like, you have to move on to the next thing. But then what happens if there is no next thing? I woke up the next morning, and for some reason, and I'm still not sure exactly what drove me to do it, but I felt the compulsion to tell my story publicly, to open up and speak. Maybe it was a cry for help, and maybe it was a frustration that I had been forced to the point of attempted suicide before I realized anything was wrong. It began with a Facebook post, opening up and telling people about this place that I'd been and the struggles that I'd had. After about 1,000 edits of rewriting and rewriting and deleting and rewriting, and I hit post and then turned the computer off. And then within about 10 minutes, my phone just started going crazy with messages from people and calls. What really struck a chord with me was all of the messages I got from people, and I've still kept every single one of them. People telling me their stories of their attempted suicides, of their depression and their mental health issues. People I either respected extremely in this industry, complete strangers, and sometimes friends who, you know, utterly surprised that they had and still are struggling with things. It was these messages that really kind of made me sit up and give me the renewed energy that I had something else to do. I mean, I'd been given a second chance, and that's where the seed for Healthy Hospo and what I do now was born. So we had the kind of soft launch for Healthy Hospo in October. And that was, it was very simple, a very basic website with a few articles on it, and a page where people could go and find out if they needed help, they could find a, whichever country they're in, a list of organizations that they could go and get some more help from. And it was just the idea to start the conversation. And it became, people wrote to me about it a lot, and it became quite popular. So then I built a bigger and better website, which is far more comprehensive. And that's the website that's still up today. And we had our official launch in January 15th. We did a big workshop in London, a full day health and wellness workshop for the hospitality industry. We had 100 people turn up. And we spoke about sleep and meditation and nutrition and mental health. We had some amazing sponsors come in and get on board. And the response to that was so incredible. And the support that I've had from the industry into Healthy Hospo and the ideas that, I have and I want to do has just been the most incredible experience, the most humbling experience, to see how everyone has come together and wants to improve the health and wellness in the industry. My favorite part of the website are the personal stories that we post from people who have just turned their lives around. And there's so many of them now that up there. So I am just one person in the industry who's kind of championing this, and I'm finding out more and more people are coming out and really getting behind this, and it's just been incredible. This year has just been so fantastic.
From 2018, that was Tim Etherington Judge, founder of Healthy Hospo. For more information, visit healthyhospo.com. And if you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, you can call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where 15 years of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. Major support for Louisiana Eats comes from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, adding local flavor to poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade for over 95 years. Blue Plate Mayo, in grocery stores everywhere or online at blueplatemayo.com. The Audubon Clubhouse from Dickie Brennan and Company, a newly renovated and expanded Audubon Park property, adds a bar and private event space to the dining room and expansive wraparound porch. Serving weekday lunch, weekend brunch, and dinner Monday through Thursday till 9 p.m. And from the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group, including Brennan's, the Napoleon House, the Redfish Grill, Ralph's on the Park, and Cafe Noma. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, and Camellia Beans. Camellia Brand's Beans for Two includes Camellia's traditional beans and a seasoning packet of spices and vegetables that make dinner for two. Available for both red beans and white beans in grocery stores everywhere or online at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating local culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas, all handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. In grocery stores everywhere or online at D'AgostinoPasta.com. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinet and Becky Retz, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.